Into FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. On a Tuesday afternoon, Brett and Patrick on the show today. Patrick Lilia, did you have any plans to go to New York over the next couple of weeks and months?
Oh, darn. Yes, my trip is thwarted.
Unless you want to sit there and quarantine for 14 days. That is the latest guidance issued by the state of New York as Minnesota has been put on the New York blacklist for some reason, because we don't really meet the criteria that's supposed to be among New York's strident, whatever you call it, guidance on which states should be blackballed or be facing a 14-day quarantine. So technically, and this is what Minnesota health officials are disputing in New York, is that the criteria in New York is that if your state has at least 10 COVID-19 cases per 100,000 or a 10% positivity test rate, you are going to be facing a 14-day quarantine. But oddly, Minnesota does not meet either of those criteria. In Minnesota, we're only getting 6 people with COVID-19 per 100,000. And our positive test rate, at least according to the Star Tribune article, it's 3%, but the numbers I calculated yesterday showed it was actually 5.1%. But either way, that's below the 10% guidance in New York, so I'm not sure necessarily why they're doing that. The only benefit I could think about this, though, with Patrick is come playoff time with Major League Baseball, perhaps that could help the Twins. If the Twins say, well, we can't go to New York, we can't face a 14-day quarantine, therefore come the playoffs, we can't play the Yankees. What do you think about that?
I think that's actually a really good strategy. Yeah, give us somebody like the Astros instead. The Twins played the Astros really well last year, so give us them instead.
Yeah, so I think Minnesota health officials might need to tamp things down a little bit. This could play out to the Minnesota Twins' advantage come playoff time in October. That's, of course, if we even have a Major League Baseball season. I remain a little skeptical, not just on baseball, but all of these professional sports, since they can't really seem to get their testing put together properly, where their testing results are coming back delayed, which doesn't really do you a whole lot of good if you don't know if you have COVID-19 until 2 or 3 days later. So, yeah, pro sports are an entire mess in that department, and I remain very skeptical that any of those are going to end up happening later this summer. The other big news today is that Joe Biden says he is open to eliminating the filibuster. And I say, about damn time, Mr. Joe Biden. As in comments to journalists made yesterday that were reported in the New York Times, Joe Biden said he hoped to create systematic change on an array of issues in the U.S., and said he was open to measures that would allow legislation to pass the Senate with a simple majority vote. And that's the only way anything could potentially happen with a Joe Biden administration, since unless somehow a miracle is pulled off and Democrats get 60 or more seats in the Senate, which even when they did that during the Obama era, they still really didn't get very much passed. That would be the only way they could get legislation passed during a Biden administration, unless they got rid of the filibuster. And Biden told reporters that though he supported the filibuster in the past and still harbors hope for bipartisan compromise, the level of defiance from Senate Republicans could influence his thought process, saying, quote, "It's going to depend on how obstructive they become," the former vice president said of Senate Republicans who might filibuster legislation championed by a potential Biden administration. Gee, you think so? Quote, "But I think you're going to have to just take a look at it," unquote, finishing off with Joe Biden there. What I hope doesn't happen is that they wait till like they're a year or a year and a half into his administration, then they think, well, maybe we should think about eliminating the filibuster. And by the time they do, they're already into the 2022 midterm elections, where inevitably Republicans will take control of the House of Representatives. Kind of a fact of life that generally whichever party wins the White House doesn't do well in the midterms. And that's what I was always thinking about when it came to the presidential primary. What candidate could stop that trend? Because your legislative goals are largely going to be done after your first 2 years. It was true under Barack Obama. It's been true under Donald Trump. And the same thing would be true under a potential Joe Biden administration. Well, speaking about who could make up that Congress that a potential Democratic majority could occupy, well, there's more primaries today that would have a big say in terms of that. Let's run through some of the big primary races that are taking place today. In Texas, we have yet another Democratic dynamic of a more centrist candidate facing off against a more progressive politician for the right to take on Republican Senator John Cornyn. We have MJ Hager, who has gotten the endorsement of a lot of establishment-type figures, including Emily's List and the Democratic Senatorial Committee. I think that's what it is, like DSC or something like that. Versus Royce West, who is the more progressive of the two candidates. Now, what's interesting about this race is that Cornyn, the Republican incumbent senator, has been somewhat meddling in this race by boosting West's profile with attacks, calling him too liberal for Texas, which could in turn help him in the primary. And that might be the thinking with Cornyn being that, well, we'll portray West as being too liberal, so he ends up with the nomination and therefore makes him easier to beat in the general election. I think that strategy might backfire, though, since typically more progressive candidates generally have more success in those types of elections in red states. As we've seen, historically, moderate Democrats usually don't have a lot of success in very red-leaning states in the past. Go back and look at the 2014 and 2016 elections when we had Democratic challengers against Republican incumbent senators, and yeah, go look and see how they did. The other big primary race to talk about is in Alabama to see who is going to be taking on Doug Jones. Doug Jones, of course, is the Democrat who was elected back in 2017 when he ran against possibly the worst candidate in American history. That would be old Judge Roy Moore, who was accused of being very creepy around teenagers back in the 1980s and 1990s. I was about to say the 1880s. I think Roy Moore might be about that old. But nonetheless, that's how Doug Jones was able to get into office and shock the world by winning that Alabama Senate seat in 2017. Well, Doug Jones is up for re-election in 2020, and the Republicans are trying to figure out who is going to challenge Jones this year. Now, the competition is between former Attorney General and former Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions. He'll be running against Alabama, former Auburn football coach, rather. Don't want to mess that up. Former Auburn football coach Tommy Tuberville. So it's Sessions versus Tuberville. And Trump has very much come down on the side of Tuberville, being that he was unhappy with the Attorney General Jeff Sessions when he occupied that office. Now, I have kind of a theory on this one here as I'm thinking through who Democrats would rather face in that race, because either way, it's going to be a very uphill battle to get Doug Jones reelected, simply because Alabama is such a ruby red state. And Patrick, you're kind of a sports guy, so chime in on this. If I'm sitting there as Doug Jones, I would rather face Tommy Tuberville than Jeff Sessions, and it's for this reason. As I mentioned, Tommy Tuberville is a former Auburn football coach, and a successful Auburn football coach at that. And if you know anything about college football in Alabama, the two major schools down there absolutely hate each other. That would be the University of Alabama and Auburn University. It's a big-time football rivalry. So if I were Doug Jones and you have Tuberville as the candidate, you couldn't do this directly with your campaign, but you could maybe do this with some outside groups. Just keep portraying Tuberville as being affiliated with Auburn and use that against him. Tell Alabama Crimson Tide fans, don't vote for this guy. You can't trust him. He's an Auburn football coach. I know it sounds silly to talk about, but that's how seriously they take their football down in Alabama. So I think I'm onto something right there. What are your thoughts?
Well, I was thinking about it since we brought up this discussion point, and I'm kind of thinking it seems kind of similar to the, I don't remember who it was, but it was in the 2012 Republican primary cycle, and their weapon against Mitt Romney was to say, Mitt Romney speaks French. You don't want someone who speaks French in office, do you?
Oh, God, I vaguely remember that. Was that a super PAC or a candidate that ran those types of ads?
I don't remember, but it just kind of reminded me of that, suggesting, oh, you don't want an Auburn guy in your Alabama Senate seat, do you?
Now, see, on the part of Doug Jones, he can't do that directly because then he risks potentially alienating Auburn fans. So he's got to do that through, like, some sort of super PAC, which, if you're a senator, it's very easy to get super PACs to do bidding on your behalf, so... I think we're onto something right there. It sounds really silly, but as you said, in 2012, they used that against Mitt Romney, saying, well, look at him. He speaks French. You can't trust him. And that football rivalry down there is basically like Vikings versus Packers, but amplified to like an 11. So if I were a Doug Jones advisor, I would say get in contact with some super PACs and try to make people paranoid about voting for Tupperville. Either way, those two primaries take place tonight in Alabama and Texas. Keep an eye on those, especially in Alabama, being that Trump is very much in favor of Tupperville and not Jeff Sessions. Hey, speaking a little more locally about primary news that we should be bringing up, we got some big news here in the 5th Congressional District. Well, not necessarily big news, but big fundraising numbers. So Antone Melton Mukes, who I interviewed on my show last week, he is challenging Ilhan Omar for the DFL endorsement in the 5th Congressional District. He raised a staggering $3.2 million in the second quarter of this year, which is a hefty sum of money, especially for someone who is challenging an incumbent representative. And Patrick, you and I were talking about before the show that, well, of course, to take on someone who is an incumbent senator or an incumbent House rep, you do need to raise that type of money. But ultimately, the question is that going to be successful against someone like Ilhan Omar, who is still relatively popular with the base of the Democrats in Minneapolis? So talk a little bit about what you were saying before the show.
Well, I was suggesting if they're putting this much money into this race that – they must think they have some kind of chance. I don't know how great of a chance. We haven't seen any polls. But as you said, Brett, our perception is that Ilhan Omar is still pretty popular in CD5. So we, you know, have our own thoughts about it. But like I was saying, if they're putting that much money into it, that they don't think they have a non-zero chance of toppling her.
Yeah, and we haven't really seen, at least I haven't seen much for polling data in that district. So, yeah, Melton Mukes certainly has his work cut out for him, just because I think you really have to try to gain that trust of DFLers, especially when you're talking about the 5th Congressional District, which very much leans blue. Sometimes when you get these primary challengers, people think, well, are they just a shadow operative for the Republicans? So that'll be a challenge, I think, for Melton Mukes going forward, is to make sure that he can say, well, yes, I am a real Democrat, and I am challenging Ilhan Omar because I think I could do a better job than her. But what's interesting, too, about this district is that even though, in theory, it's not very competitive, well, at least when we talk about the general election, as we brought up earlier, when it comes to the primary, that remains to be seen. But then the general election, whoever gets the DFL nomination is clearly going to be a heavy favorite to win that congressional seat. In fact, I think we can pretty much call that race tonight, or right as we speak, saying whoever gets the DFL nomination is going to win. But the Republicans are still also, for some reason, pouring some money into that district. Not the Republicans directly, but if you look at some of the GOP sides of who's trying to challenge Omar, there's a couple of candidates who are on there, including, oh gosh, Patrick, I'm blanking right now. Who's the infamous woman who's running in that district that has that checkered criminal history? Yeah, you're blanking on her name too. I know Matt does an impression of her. Danielle Stella, that's who I'm thinking of, Danielle Stella. And there's another guy running, too, that also has raised a substantial amount of money. I think it was like well over $1 million. And it was funny when I saw an article about this race a couple of months ago. they were talking about how some of these races that aren't very competitive in the general election are still raising a lot of money. It might have been like ProPublica who did a study on this or an article. And they reached out to some of these people who donated to like Republicans that were running in the 5th district. And once ProPublica reached out to them and said, well, you know you're donating to a district that's like 80% Democratic, they would say, well, why am I sending my money there? Because the perception is that, oh, well, I'm sending my money to a district to defeat Ilhan Omar or to defeat Rashida Tlaib or whoever else. Pick whichever politician you want without knowing that those districts aren't competitive whatsoever. So, yeah, it is kind of funny as I look through like at CD5, which is not a very competitive district. It actually has raised a ton of money for both Democrats and Republicans. One other piece of news regarding campaign finance. Let's go to CD7, where everyone's favorite Democrat, Colin Peterson, is running for re-election. He'll very likely be facing Michelle Fischbach, who is a former state legislature and former lieutenant governor under odd circumstances. Yeah, she was a Republican lieutenant governor under a Democratic governor, Mark Dayton, due to some weird circumstances last year, which we won't get into. But she's challenging Colin Peterson, and she has raised $317,000 in second quarter filings, which, of course, pales in comparison to what was raised in CD5. But interestingly, though, that $317,000 she raised, that was more than Colin Peterson. In fact, it's been more than Colin Peterson in every full quarter since she entered the race last fall. And CD7 has been getting closer and closer every election cycle, so that'll be one to watch this fall. But as I've brought up a few times in the past, even if Republicans are able to pick up CD7, does it mean much in the long run? Because very likely after 2020, Minnesota is going to lose a congressional district. And being that CD7 is more rural and has a population that's not growing as fast of the state, most of that district is probably going to be enveloped by CD8. We're at 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. See, I ran long talking about all this election news. Had a whole lot I wanted to get through talking about what's going on at the state legislature. Maybe we'll try to get to that in the next segment, but a very busy show ahead of us, as coming up in the third segment, we're going to be joined by Greta Call of MinnPost talking about a new study that she just wrote about that talked about how the number of people who live in neighborhoods that are deemed as being in poverty has doubled since 1980, more than doubled. We're going to be speaking with her coming up later on in the show, right around 2:35. Before we head to break, though, Gary in Minneapolis has been hanging on forever. Let's talk to him. Hi there, Gary.
Yeah, there's a good chance we'll lose a congressional seat. We almost lost one last census, but I hope you're right. I was thinking of that. Put 7th and 8th largely together. But what I called about was I can't pronounce his name right against Omar. I was very skeptical of someone raising that kind of money. And then after that, Matt said the other day, there's stories about Republicans sowing money, probably what you call fake Democrats or corporate Democrats, whatever, and around the country doing some of that. Mm-hmm. So anyways, it makes me wary anybody has raised that kind of money for a primary. But I was going to say also, here's something positive. You know, as I'll be going with them, but as the older generations die off, there's going to be more and more of these students that got this Republican debt from college. You know, when I went to college, they paid their taxes, the rich, and funded the states and cities, so that you could go through college without getting in debt. And so I tell young people that, and they're amazed. I mean, if you live at home with your folks also. But as we die off, more and more of these young people, it's much more diverse, which means much more Democrat. You got students that are in debt. You got more minority races. And so that's the only hope is we got to win until that happens. But somebody said, I think it was 300,000 less of the elderly voters who are more conservative. You know, not just baby boomers, under them too, they're getting them. But less of them voting, and more of these students will start voting, these young people start voting.
All right, Gary, as always, appreciate the phone call. Lots of good stuff. Going back to that CD5 race, as I did bring up earlier on the show, we had Antone Milton Mukes on Friday's show. We have reached out to the Ilhan Omar campaign to see if she would like to join me on the show. Still awaiting a response on that one, so hopefully we'll have a chance to chat with her in the near future. We'll take a break and come on back with some quick news from the state legislature as you're listening to FYI Politics with Brett Johnson.
Is your remote workforce putting your company at risk? Cyber criminals are targeting your employees with COVID-19-inspired emails and attacking businesses like yours. Hi, Mark Sommerfeld from Rimark. Rimark has the tools and expertise to enable your employees to work securely from home. If you need help getting your staff to work remotely and securely, call 651-328-8900 or go to RimarkIT.com. That's 651-328-8900 or RimarkIT.com.
I'm Rick Unger. You've heard the screamers. You've heard the shouters, the haters, the beraters. Well, now it's time to listen to a real conversation, a rational conversation. Now it's time for the Rick Unger Show.
Listen to the Rick Unger Show every weekday from 5 to 7 p.m. on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Stream at am950radio.com or search KTNF on the TuneIn app.
Hi, this is Chad from AM 950. Whether it's storm damage from the past or a new issue that's popped up over the years, Snap Construction is the company we trust for all roofing, siding, windows, and exterior construction needs. Snap Construction is arguably the most well-reviewed roofing, siding, and window company in the metro. Ryan has worked with many of our listeners and is excited to help more.
Thank you to all the listeners we have worked with and all the listeners at AM 950 that we haven't had the opportunity to work with yet. This is Ryan, owner of Snap Construction. Safety of our homeowners and our team at Snap Construction has always been the utmost priority. We are still offering free, no-contact estimates. This summer at Snap Construction, we've rolled out a new referral program. Mention AM950, and we'll make a donation to the station in your name. Together, we can all work to ensure AM950 continues to thrive and grow in our communities. Call for your free estimate today. 612-333-SNAP, 612-333-SNAP.
Hazel's Northeast is back and offering some of the most creatively prepared comfort food you'll find. Delicious breakfast options include the slow-cooked brisket hash, chicken fried steak, and the famed drunken banana French toast. Or for lunch and dinner, there's Swedish meatballs, wild rice gumbo, and more. Hazel's Northeast is open Wednesdays through Saturdays, 8 to 8, and Sundays, 9 to 2. Hazel's Northeast delivers real good food. Family-owned at 29th and Johnson in Minneapolis. Make your reservation now at hazelsne2go.com.
During this stay-at-home time, many of us are getting around to what needs doing at home. So how is your vacuum cleaner running? Is it time to get it repaired or maybe even replaced? Great news! A1 Vacuum in Roseville is open for curbside service. We're here from 10 until 2 Monday through Saturday. Give us a call at 651-222-6316 to place your order for curbside supplies, repairs, or replacements. Find more information and updates at a-1vacuum.com.
Back on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. Got a short second segment, but let's give you a rundown of what's been happening at the state legislature. So, at least among the leaders of both the Minnesota House and the Minnesota Senate and Governor Tim Walz, they have reached a tentative agreement on a $1.8 billion bonding bill, though that doesn't mean it will still officially be signed into law, because keep in mind with bonding bills, you do need 60% of the vote in each chamber, which means you still need the minority party in both the House and the Senate, at least a few of those members, to be on board. That would mean minority Republicans in the House and minority Democrats in the Senate. And even though the leaders, that would be House Speaker Melissa Hortman and Senate Majority Leader Paul Gazelka, say they've reached an agreement with Walz, does not mean it'll necessarily get through. And throwing more water on that is Kurt Dowd, who is the House Minority Leader. And he said, just to be clear, there is no agreement on a bonding bill, and he is not on board yet. Also news out of the Senate, of course, we saw that tweet yesterday from Paul Gazelka when he said that the emergency part of the pandemic was over, which was just an absolutely silly statement to make on his part. What is interesting about Gazelka's district is that not only is he facing a Democratic challenger, he's also being primaried. And there is a group located in his district which is very right-leaning, that is anti-Gazelka. Yeah, they don't think Gazelka is conservative enough. This group is called Via Action for Liberty. Or Action for Liberty. I think this is what Via Action for Liberty. Blame the press release on this one. But they've put out statements saying, why is Republican Majority Leader Paul Gazelka cutting deals with Democrats while Tim Walz's emergency powers still exist? Metro Democrats want to bail out Jacob Fry's mess in Minneapolis with our money. We say no. Why is Gazelka making these deals? So you do wonder if this is partially playing into the thinking of Paul Gazelka, how he's really gone off and tried to appease more of the conservative side of his party. Because initially when he was elected the Senate Majority Leader, at least the perception in the media was that he was going to be a more moderate voice, but that really hasn't happened, especially here in 2020. And you wonder if some of this has to do with the fact that he is facing a primary challenge in his own district. And one more piece of news out of the state legislature, actually two more pieces of news out of the state legislature. One is that a supplemental budget that the Minnesota House Ways and Means Committee passed includes a long-discussed $500 one-time payment to each welfare family. The money would come from CARES Act money, which I guess is better than nothing, a one-time payment of $500. Beats what happens in lots of other states where generally they end up trying to cut welfare programs. So I guess kind of a step in the right direction. But if you're someone sitting there on welfare, be nice if it would be a little bit more than just a one-time payment of $500, especially with what's happening with the pandemic. And then the House Committee, one of the House committees, just passed a resolution declaring racism a public health crisis. So that also is some news out of the state legislature. All right, coming up next, we're going to be speaking with Greta Call of MinnPost about this new piece she reported on. She is the data reporter over at MinnPost, and she just put out this study talking about how between 1980 and 2018, the number of neighborhoods in Hennepin and Ramsey counties with high levels of poverty, where they define that as basically where 30% or more of residents had incomes below the poverty line, that number has doubled since 1980. Yeah, there's some trickle-down economics for you. We're going to be speaking with Greta about that piece she just wrote over at MinnPost coming up next on FYI Politics.
Now, more than ever, we are being faced daily with the topic of human mortality. And for many people, estate planning has been top of mind. Getting your estate planning done now can be easy and cost-effective. Schroman Law offers virtual options for initial consultations so that new clients can safely initiate the process. With many facing uncertain financial situations, Schroman Law also offers affordable fees for legal documents. Learn more at schromanlaw.com. That's schromenlaw.com.
Finding the best foods the Twin Cities has to offer is easy with eatlocalminnesota.com. Offering the top local and independently owned restaurants, eatlocalminnesota.com has everything from burger joints to cocktails and fine dining.
Cafe Latte's award-winning gourmet cafeteria has reopened to indoor dining at 50% capacity, so come check out their pizza and wine bar, or get a treat from the bakery made fresh daily. Plus, they still have online ordering and takeout, along with gift cards at cafelatte.com. That's Cafe Latte, located off Victoria and Grand in St. Paul. Crooner's Supper Club has two great options this summer for enjoying live music from a safe distance. Their Lakeside Drive-In Concerts, enjoyed from the comfort of your car, and the brand new Lakeside Cafe with sheltered table seating for couples and parties of four. It's a more intimate, distance-safe way to enjoy great food and top-name Twin Cities performers in the open air. That's Crooner's off Moore Lake and Highway 65. Reservations at croonersmn.com.
Hi, this is Laura. These are indeed confusing times. So much of our life, education, business, meetings have moved online, yet not everyone has internet access. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, is here for everyone. Radio reaches people without internet. In fact, radio reaches more Americans than any other platform. 92% of U.S. adults listen to radio every week. Radio connects. If you know some organization, maybe a religious or civic group, seeking to engage and knows that a Zoom call costs money and does not reach everyone, consider a taped or live broadcast on AM 950. Perhaps a virtual not-so-silent auction, recovery support, spiritual support, business networking, poetry slam. If you want to learn more about creating a live or taped message on AM 950, call 952-946-8885 or email laura@am950radio.com. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, here for everyone.
Hi, Alex of Better Futures Minnesota. Does your business or organization need janitorial services, lawn care, or snow services? Obtain a free, no-obligation estimate from Better Futures Minnesota when you mention that you heard about us on AM 950. Our supervised, hardworking, and affordable crews will handle your interior and exterior building and property maintenance needs while you help men in your community transform their lives and walk on a positive path to success. It's a win-win. To learn more, go to betterfuturesminnesota.com under Business Services.
With your AM 950 weather, I'm Brett Johnson. Look for scattered rain showers today with a high near 72. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low around 57. Wednesday, partly cloudy with a high near 82. And Thursday, sunny with a high around 84.
The heat wave means it's time to save at Standard Heating and Air Conditioning. During July, get instant savings of $700 on air conditioners, including ductless systems. Be sure to ask about 0% financing with payments as low as $50 per month. Visit standardheating.com.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. You're back on the Tuesday edition of FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. So according to new research by the Economic Innovation Group, between 1980 and 2018, the number of neighborhoods in both Hennepin and Ramsey counties with high levels of poverty, which are defined as having 30% or more of residents with incomes below the poverty line, that number has more than doubled. We had 19 high-poverty neighborhoods in the Twin Cities in 1980. In 2018, that number had grown to a staggering 41. Greta Call is MinPost's data reporter, and she did some reporting on this new study that was just released a couple of days ago, and she joins us now on the show. Hey there, Greta. How's it going today?
It's good. How are you doing?
Doing good here. So, yeah, as I was just reading through this report and looking at these numbers, my initial reaction was, well, I figured, yeah, we probably had seen an increase in poverty with neighborhoods that, yeah, are experiencing systemic poverty. But this is a pretty jarring statistic to have these double. What were your kind of initial reactions?
Yeah, so it is really interesting to see those numbers double. And actually, didn't make it into the story, but over time, if you look decade by decade, the number increased a lot in the 80s. In the 80s. The 1990s, which were kind of a more broadly prosperous time, the number went down a little bit. But then during the 2000s, we had the Great Recession, so the number was huge and then really hasn't recovered. There's a little bit less than there was in 2010, but we still haven't recovered to previous levels in terms of neighborhoods experiencing poverty.
So as you were looking through some of this data, what areas of Hennepin and Ramsey County were hit hardest? Did we see any trends, like in terms of which regions of the cities were potentially getting hit the hardest?
So there isn't an exact pattern. The researchers at the Economic Innovation Group who did this project broke neighborhoods up into four different categories. Newly poor neighborhoods were neighborhoods that had less than 20% of people living in poverty in 1980, and then today have more than 30%, so they fit that high poverty definition. We see that in parts of Near North, Camden, Powderhorn, Cedar Riverside, and this was the one suburban tract that made it in terms of having a census tract with high poverty. There's part of Brooklyn Park that went from having 5% poverty to 31% of people living in poverty. So that's one of those. Some neighborhoods have experienced deepening poverty in that time frame. So that means they had between 20 and 30% of people living in poverty, so that wouldn't meet that high poverty definition in 1980. But today they have more than 30% of people living in poverty. Some of the neighborhoods that we see there are parts of Seward in Minneapolis along Hiawatha, parts of Near North, and then parts of Thomasdale. And right near downtown Minneapolis, we have Stevens Square, which, for example, went from 29% to 43% of people living in poverty between the 80s and today. The other group was neighborhoods that were persistently poor in that time period. So those were neighborhoods that, met that high poverty definition in 1980 and still meet it today. If you think areas, the area of Thomasdale that surrounds the Minnesota State Capitol in St. Paul is one that meets that definition. And if you look at, every 10 years at the census data, it's been between 40 and 60% of people around there living in poverty for the last 40 years.
Talk a little bit about the racial and demographic makeup of some of these neighborhoods that were hardest hit in terms of having residents that were having income that was below the poverty line.
Yeah, so I think it's important to talk about, like, why are we studying these areas of high poverty? And the reason is that people who live in poverty are facing challenges every day, whether it's having more trouble getting health care, having more trouble just kind of with other things like that. But living in these areas of concentrated poverty tends to exacerbate those problems, because you're not only facing the challenges that you personally are facing as someone living in poverty, but you are also facing challenges that your neighborhood is facing, whether that's struggling schools or could be a lack of job networks in a lot of these neighborhoods. But areas of concentrated poverty also have a role in perpetuating some of the racial inequalities that we see in the Twin Cities. Minneapolis and St. Paul have some of the worst racial disparities in the United States in terms of major metropolitan areas. And when you look at this data, while the majority, I think it's important to note that the majority of people who are Black in the Twin Cities do not live in areas of concentrated poverty, but Black people are seven times more likely to live in areas of concentrated poverty than white people are in the Twin Cities. Nationally, they're six times more likely. So that disparity is worse in the Twin Cities than it is on average across the country.
Yeah, and that is another pretty jarring number, yeah, that they're seven times more likely to be living in one of these types of neighborhoods than a person who isn't Black. Talking about some of these communities that were included among these, or some of these neighborhoods that were included among these 41, when we are comparing that data from 1980 to 2018, were there any neighborhoods that were meeting this threshold in 1980 that were able to move out by 2018? So in other words, neighborhoods that kind of moved in the other direction and were able to get out of the point where they had a high number of residents who were in poverty?
Yeah, so that's something interesting that the study looked at, and they found actually on a national level that's pretty rare. Only, I think, 14% of neighborhoods that were high poverty in 1980 became not high poverty anymore, or less than 20% of people in poverty by 2018, sorry. So that's 40 years. That's a long, or more than 40 years now. That's a long turnaround time. And yet it's really rare for these neighborhoods to be no longer high poverty neighborhoods. In the Twin Cities, there was just one neighborhood that met this definition. And I always tell people, if you're a data reporter, you still have to be a reporter, because if you look at the North Loop, it's the one neighborhood that would fit that definition. So that's kind of the old warehouse district in Minneapolis. But what was going on there in the last, several decades is it went from being this neighborhood where very few people lived there, it was mostly warehouses and stuff like that, to becoming this generally more higher-end neighborhood. So just the number of people who have lived there has increased so much in that time period that I don't think it quite counts as a turnaround neighborhood. It's more of one that's seen a lot of residential development.
So as you were talking to some of the researchers with this study, I'm guessing they probably found some common threads in these communities in terms of the challenges that a lot of these residents were facing. Can you talk a little bit about that and even some of the solutions they were kind of proposing to help neighborhoods get out of these situations?
Yeah, so they didn't get into solutions as much, but I think one thing that's interesting about high poverty neighborhoods is, other than being high poverty, there's not necessarily that many common threads. We do see things like They tend to have more high concentrations of people of color living in them. But in terms of things like college education and whether people own a car and things like that, we don't see as much of a unifying profile there, which I think is interesting. You'll talk to researchers who say what unites these neighborhoods is that they have high concentrations of poverty. It's not that they fit some specific profile.
I know this wasn't necessarily part of this study, but do they have any data or any thoughts on what could possibly be happening in the suburbs as well? Because that would be a really interesting place to look at, because, as you said, this primarily focused on Hennepin and Ramsey County, which includes Minneapolis and St. Paul. But did they have any data on what's happening in the suburbs? I think you were alluding to Brooklyn Park. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so we do know that, like, if you look at census data, we've seen an increase of poverty in the suburbs. And guessing it just, this study sort of looks at whether it meets that 30% or more threshold or not. So there just aren't that many tracts in the suburbs that do meet that threshold. But, you know, you can find tracts that have, just because of geography, maybe 20% of people are living in poverty and 80% of people aren't. Does that mean that there's not poverty there? Absolutely not. But it wouldn't meet the threshold in a study like this. But, yeah, we're definitely seeing more poverty in the suburbs than we used to.
And how do we compare to other places around the country? Did the researchers have any information on that, how Minnesota compared to other places around the U.S.?
So Minnesota doesn't have quite the concentration of tracts of people in poverty as you might see in what people like to call Rust Belt cities. But the researchers did note that Minneapolis in some ways is sort of like a microcosm of what's happening in the U.S. Because it's sort of this quintessential blue chip metro area economy, where if you look at the stats on the aggregate, people tend to be doing pretty well, but that sort of masks these giant disparities that are happening and also kind of shows you that despite fairly broad prosperity, it hasn't done a lot to bring neighborhoods that have been in poverty for a long time out of poverty or stop the creation of new neighborhoods that have high concentration of poverty.
We're speaking with Greta Call. She is the data reporter over at MinPost, that is minpost.com, about this new study that was put out showing that between 1980 and 2018, the number of neighborhoods in Hennepin and Roundsey counties with high levels of poverty has more than doubled, and really encourage you to check out her reporting on that over at minpost.com and lots of her other work since, well, I'm kind of a stats and data guy, so definitely enjoy checking that stuff out. Greta, really appreciate the time today, and thanks for joining me and talking about this.
Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely, and make sure you give Greta a follow over on Twitter as well. Her handle is @GretaCall, and again, you can find her writings over at minpost.com. We'll take a break and come on back with a few miscellaneous stories as you're on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson.
The Minnesota Army National Guard salutes the high school graduating class of 2020. We recognize all of your hard work and the resilience you've demonstrated during this historic time for our country. Those are the traits of a great citizen soldier. You can continue to stand out and be a leader in your community as a soldier in the Minnesota Army National Guard. Learn more about the benefits of part-time service in the Army National Guard at NationalGuard.com. Sponsored by the Minnesota Army National Guard, aired by the Minnesota Broadcasters Association and this station.
Nightingale at 26th and Lindale in Minneapolis can't wait to see you when they open for patio and indoor dining later this summer. But right now, they're open for curbside takeout and wine every day from 4 to 9 p.m. Offerings include the famous Nightingale Burger and Fries, Ginger Tamari Chicken Wings, Duck Pastrami Reuben, Picnic Snacks, Provisions, Chocolate Pot au Creme, and more. View the menu at nightingalempls.com or call 612-354-7060 to order. And make sure to ask about Nightingale's gift card specials and staff support t-shirts.
Hi, this is Paul Metza inviting you to listen to the Wall of Power Radio Hour. We have been on the air on AM 950 for over 5 years, over 200 original shows in the can, including musicians, artists, promoters, authors, comedians, and more. We're on the air Saturdays at 6 p.m. If you'd like to advertise, get a hold of us at am950radio.com. And stay tuned this weekend, Wall of Power Radio Hour.
Hi, everyone. Matt McNeil here. I want to thank everyone from the bottom of my heart who's become a member of AM 950 over the last few weeks. You can become a member by simply heading over to am950radio.com and donating. The membership response has been so great, we're planning on launching some brand new members-only content, like a monthly Tom Hartman interview and weekly updates with new content. Head over to am950radio.com and declare, yes, I want to support AM 950. For everyone who is a member, thank you so very much for your support, and thanks for listening to the progressive voice of Minnesota, AM 950.
Hi, this is Chad Hobart with Social Media MN. If you're running for office or a grassroots ballot initiative, getting out door-to-door made a lot of sense before coronavirus. Progressive candidates historically win elections with one-to-one voter contact, door-knocking, and by organizing. With coronavirus, candidates and ballot initiatives need to pivot and recalibrate with a digital marketing strategy to provide one-to-one voter contact and organizing opportunities. An effective digital strategy will likely determine if your race goes blue this year or whether you're singing the blues. So, if you want to be singing Hail to the Chief on Election Day, Social Media MN can help. For a hassle-free consultation, contact us today at 763-244-4058. That's 763-244-4058. Or visit us online at socialmediamn.com. That's socialmediamn.com.
And we're back on the final segment of FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. Yeah, any surprise that the number of neighborhoods that were in poverty doubled since 1980? Gee, I wonder what happened in 1980. Oh, yeah, that's when Ronald Reagan was elected, and that's when we had the real onset of supply-side economics and kind of the end of the New Deal era. Not saying everything was great prior to 1980, but certainly what we saw with a lot of those supply-side and trickle-down economics certainly just accelerated the situation that people are facing when, unfortunately, they reach hard financial times. Speaking of hard financial times, this is kind of a depressing start, or just depressing stat, rather. New study finds that 5.4 million Americans have lost their employer-provided health insurance as the pandemic sweeps through the country. Yeah, 5.4 million Americans that have lost their employer-provided insurance. And yet we still have Obamacare, which is being challenged in the Supreme Court by the Trump administration, although at least the latest news out of there shows that the SCOTUS is not likely to rule on that prior to the 2020 election. But this just goes to what I was kind of talking about with Joe Biden getting rid of the filibuster, or at least being in favor of it. Because, yeah, we look at that and say, all right, well, we have 5.4 million Americans who are losing their employer-provided health insurance. Meanwhile, we have Republicans who are pushing for the repeal of Obamacare. Yeah, the argument we'll hear from Democrats is, oh, well, please don't repeal my Obamacare. And not a whole lot else. It's just playing defense against what Republicans are doing. Not much on the offense side in terms of trying to get more people health insurance. And that's what needs to be the focus, and maybe we could get to that point without a filibuster, because the only way, at least at the federal level, you're going to get people more access and, well, not access, that's not the right way to put it, at least more coverage with health insurance is by getting something passed through Congress, and as long as you have a filibuster, fat chance of that ever happening. J.P. Morgan Chase and other national news notched higher than expected earnings in the second quarter, but braced for losses from borrowers defaulting on their loans as the bank's outlook for the U.S. economy becomes more pessimistic. Now, here's why I'm bringing this up. Because in the next round of stimulus funding, or maybe a bailout bill next year, because certainly the economic impact of what's happening from COVID-19 is not going away anytime soon. And what I'm about to read, keep this in mind when we hear more about these bailout and stimulus packages, especially when we talk about bailing out more private businesses or bailing out banks. So check this out. J.P. Morgan, the biggest bank in the country, set aside $10.5 billion to cover potential losses on its bank loans, cutting aggressively into their profits, which came in at $4.7 billion. Its decision to build up reserves reflects further deterioration, and increased uncertainty in the macroeconomic outlook as a result of the impact of COVID-19, the firm said in a press release. So yeah, what they're doing is putting a whole bunch of money aside to cover potential losses from people defaulting on their loans. And keep that in mind, because I'm guessing we're going to hear this, maybe not in the upcoming debate about a new stimulus bill, but at least at some point in the next couple of years when Congress is talking about bailing out banks or bailing out private businesses, we're probably going to hear banks come back out and say, well, look at all these people defaulting on their loans. We need help to make sure we keep our liquidity and we can stay in business. Just keep in mind that being reported here in the summer of 2020, they already have set aside $10.5 billion to cover their potential losses. So, yeah, right now, in theory, they're prepared for it, but probably still won't stop them from going to Congress and even state legislatures and asking for bailout money. New polling data out of the University of Maryland School of Public Policy shows that 90% of respondents support body cameras for police, including 85% of Republicans, 86% of independents, and 94% of Democrats. Also in this study, 82% of respondents supported the duty to intervene, 71% of Republicans, 78% of independents, 94% of Democrats. So interesting data right there, polling data showing that even a large majority of Republicans are in support of some of the most absolute basic police reforms. All right, and one final thing to bring up, because last Friday we saw Donald Trump commute the sentence of Roger Stone. And Republicans like to point out, well, look at the questionable pardons and commutations that were done by Bill Clinton when he was in office. Well, Peter Baker over at lawfareblog.com reports that in 31 of the 36 pardons or commutations by Donald Trump, the act advanced the president's political goals or benefited someone he had a personal connection to. That would be 31 of the 36 pardons or commutations he's issued so far. And that is way higher than what we've seen from previous presidents, including Barack Obama, George W. Bush, George H.W. Bush, and Bill Clinton. They, in fact, even talked about how, yeah, even W. Bush, the last Republican, didn't pardon or commute the sentences of that many people that had personal connections or political connections to the president. So keep that in mind that, yeah, Bill Clinton certainly did have some questionable pardons and commutations, especially when he pardoned his brother Roger and also Susan McDougal. But it was nowhere near the levels of what we've seen from Donald Trump, according to Peter Baker over at lawfareblog.com. Again, you can check that out over at lawfareblog.com. Well, I'm just about all out of time on my show. Stay tuned. We got Matt McNeil coming up next here on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota.